57. The first way to come into talking about this is to look at the time period of the 1870s. 1873, there was a panic or an economic downturn in the country. And let me just go right off the topic of strikes and start talking panics for two reasons. One is I think it'll make everything else make more sense. And I know more about panics anyway than strikes. I like that. But in 1819, there was a panic. You don't have to write all this down until we get back to the railroad strike. But 1819, there was a panic. 1837, there's a panic. 1857, there's a small one. 1873, there's this one. This one's the largest one so far in the time period. Then 20 years later, in 1893, there is the worst one of the century. There won't be another big one at all until the stock market crash in 1929. But if you look at what we just defined there from 1819 to 37 to 57 to 73 to 93, it's not always on target, but it's kind of following what kind of a schedule? About 20 years, 20 to 25 years in there. So, in between those panics were usually great heights of economic growth and prosperity. So, what might economists or the average ordinary person conclude about this? That there's a cycle. There's a predictable cycle, and therefore, in the next 20 years or so, you can expect, if you're in the down part of it, a high part or a trough to reoccur in terms of a crisis. And that becomes actually worse than not even predicting cycles, because lots of times people will start to invest or stop investing in anticipation of these things. The 1893 panic is considered to have been self-started by enough people wringing their hands and screaming a panic's coming and the sky finally fell, that kind of thinking. But the 73 panic, again, was the worst one so far in that century. Lots of people had their opinions of what caused it. The most popular opinion was, this is true for 93 also, is that bankers trying to keep the gold standard near and dear purposely shrank or contracted the money that was available in circulation to make their own holdings more precious, triggering the recession. Now, that really doesn't make a lot of economic sense, because you don't make money as a banker by causing depressions. But those who wanted to inflate the money supply saw that. So, 73, 74, 75, during those years, it's hard times for all. You may read in your textbook about something I won't talk about called the Molly Maguires. They were an Irish mining group that were kind of violent in their protests. Again, bringing back that European image of labor unrest. That occurs from 74 to 75. So, 73 through 75 is a time when economically things are very shaky, and those at the bottom of the economic ladder feel it the worst. Another feature that occurs in this period, not in America, but in Paris in 1871, is the Paris Communards, or Commune Uprising. That's, again, something you don't have to write down, but it follows the Franco-Prussian War, and it was clearly a worker socialist movement that not only dealt with the people involved in the strike, but it touched the heart and the cord of everybody in Paris. And so a general strike occurred across Paris and then parts of France. There was the fear that it was going to lead to a European full continental strike and protest and rally. It didn't, but it had in earlier years in Europe in 1848 and 1830 that had happened. So what I'm trying to get at is the climate of the 1870s is there this kind of rumblings of underground labor unrest ready to turmoil break through? And when in 1877... a railroad strike spreads all across the country in 42 different sites, it seems to fit into this time period. It starts in West Virginia with wage cuts, leads to Pittsburgh, in which they put double locomotives or double headers on the trains to pull them, which means they can hire less people to work on the line, so that creates layoffs. But sympathy strikes, rallies, and demonstrations go as far as San Francisco and Seattle and Chicago, again, about 42 places. Saw some kind of either sympathy demonstrations and rallies or actual violent protests by railroad workers online. In many cases, unrelated to the incidences in West Virginia and Pittsburgh that started it. To me, it kind of gives me this feeling when I read this. Anybody remember Rodney King? What's the Rodney King story? Why did it invoke a riot? Okay, they were filmed, right? By someone who they didn't know was filming them. And although the defense attorneys of the police said they didn't see the first part before the film that led to it, seeing that on the film was bad enough for most people that it didn't seem at all just or fair. And these police were acquitted or given light sentences. They were later run through a different trial on different charges and finally convicted on something else through the double jeopardy method. But before all that happened, it triggered not only strikes, I don't know, strikes, but riots in Los Angeles, but sympathy riots in Atlanta and Seattle and Chicago and other places. Now, there wasn't anything to do with Rodney King in these other cities, so why were those things breaking out? That's it. The belief that police in general tended to be unfair and racist in their in profiling, et cetera, in their tactics. So someone might say, well, there was no relationship, but I think when a community of that many people start to all at once rise up in protest and sympathy, there's some kind of linkage going on there. And that's the parallel I'm trying to make is that's what caused the railroad workers to rise up. That there was a feeling that the workers on the railroad lines, by and large across the nation, were mistreated. And if it was the first time that any kind of cross-national strike had occurred. So employers, not just railroad owners, but employers of factories in general, thinking of what happens in Europe, still the lingering effects of the 1873 panic, there was this feeling, has it finally come to America that it's that people are class-minded and violently revolutionary? Is this going to be some communist revolution? And it's probably that kind of fear is what led to asking Rutherford B. Hayes to take a lot of state militia and nationalize them into federal authority, using federal troops now in order to suppress these demonstrations and these riots. It declined as quickly as it arose in a matter of days. And the specter of socialist revolution dissipated and disappeared. And so I often wonder why is so much of it made in the textbooks? And I come to two conclusions. It's in a lot of textbooks. Two conclusions. One is, if it truly frightened that many people and business ownership across the country, then it really is. Anytime you have some great first national movement that occurs, it's of meritorious mention. Other side of that is, who tends to go into the historical community more often than not? Who becomes history teachers? Newt Gingrich being an exception. He was a history instructor that doesn't fit my mold. Liberals. Leftists. That's who goes into the history community. They're not all that way, but they're disproportionately that way. And so something like this is just grist for the mill. You know? The mention that the poor working class is being exploited by the ownership class, and here's proof that they're all across the country rising up. So I, and being a leftist myself, I sympathize with wanting to try to push that story. But I often wonder how accurate it actually is. Is it just one of those kind of moments that occur in flash, or was there really some underlying connection or linkage taking place? The second strike we'll mention here is in item 36, the Homestead Steel Strike. Homestead being a suburb of Pittsburgh, owned by Carnegie. It is 1 year away from this 1893 panic that I mentioned. So things are already economically shaky. People are expecting and anticipating a problem to occur. Carnegie plans to go back home to Scotland for a vacation, but he also wants to try to do some cost-cutting measures without having to face up to the responsibility of what follows. And so he leaves it to the plant manager, Henry Clay Frick, to announce the layoffs and the wage cuts, which are going to be pretty substantial. It's not only a way of trying to absorb and avoid losses, it's a purposeful effort to crush a budding new union movement listed here, the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers. They just didn't want this union taking hold, and so by the layoffs and the firings, especially of all the leadership of this organization, they hope to put it out of business. But Carnegie leaves it to Frick to do it. Frick does it. And it naturally is poorly received, and eventually it turns violent as workers go on strike. Frick calls in Pinkerton, those detectives that we've mentioned that like to hire out to break strikes. But the workers, with people in the city in sympathy with them, are just too big to handle, and the Pinkertons are chased off. Eventually, troops are brought in and it is quelled, but in the process Frick is stabbed. He doesn't die, but he's stabbed in his office one night by one of the striking workers. And it seems that the attitude and the harshness that Frick responded to the strike is what got the workers the most upset. They never really blamed Carnegie as much as they did Frick, but in reality it was Carnegie's plans that he left with Frick when he took off. And that's why this is a non-proven theory of mine. But I'm thinking this, that when you hear people say frickin' this and frickin' that, I don't think they mean the F word. I think they mean Henry Clay Frick. I'm almost of the assumption that that's where that kind of association came from. Frick was mad at Carnegie also, and after Carnegie came back, they, through representatives, negotiated to share what each owned. They never spoke to each other again after that. It did crush the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers Union, and no unionization of the steel industry was able to get a hold until the 1930s during the New Deal period. And that, again, was a series of violent strikes that occurred in small steel companies and finally capitulating and recognizing the AFFL. But the one I find the most interesting, I guess because the personalities involved, is the 1894 Pullman strike of Item 37. And this one is clearly related to the effects of the 1893 panic. Pullman, George Pullman, was the inventor of the dining car and the sleeping car for railroads. He made a lot of money in this regards. In fact, he kind of had the monopoly over trains like maybe Gates has over software. There was a city south of Chicago, north of Gary, Indiana, called Pullman, Illinois, and it was the classic company town. Company town in the sense that everybody in Pullman either worked for him or was dependent upon his workers and factory for their livelihood. Most everything was owned by him. Not only the plant, but the rental property where his workers lived was owned by Pullman. Grocery stores, the dry goods stores, the clothing stores, all of that were Pullman owned, yes. Illinois, south of Chicago, a little bit north of Gary, Indiana. And in fact, workers weren't even paid in currency. They were paid in script. Kind of like Disney dollars, or if you've ever been that route where you give them a 20 and they give you back 17 bucks worth of Disney change, only good for spending there. That's kind of the way the Pullman worked. Everything came back to Pullman in that fashion. So it was bad enough and hard enough to live and work in that area. But when the 1893 panic hit, Pullman did as others did, and that is layoffs and wage cuts to try to absorb the losses. And it triggered a corresponding strike by the Pullman workers. But the strike at the Pullman Company in 1894 will move beyond just the company and eventually into the Chicago shipping yards because of the actions taken by Eugene Victor Debs in Item 37. Debs, a labor organizer from way back in family, had been also like Gompers, but far more radical. Debs had organized the ARU, or the American Railway Union, and was trying to get workers in many different factories in different cities to join and try to make it eventually become a national union. What Debs did was to launch a secondary strike in sympathy to the striking Pullman workers. So what it would be is this. When trains would come into the Chicago yards, Debs informed his workers in the union, check the trains, and if a Pullman car is attached, don't service the car. So the car can't move, the whole train can't move on until someone is brought in to service the car. And in essence, it won't happen because people won't cross the lines. And that way, they hoped that would force the other train company owners to put pressure on Pullman to capitulate in the strike. Well, instead of doing that, these owners got together and organized the Railway Managers Association. And they said, we're not going to turn on each other because if we turn on Pullman, they'll pick us apart one at a time. So we're going to stay organized together against the union members. And what we'll do is we'll put federal mail in the Pullman cars. So therefore, if the people refuse to service the train, they'll be in violation of federal law of stopping mail delivery. Well, Debs caught wind of what this was all about, so he informed the workers to check each car carefully. If it's got mail on it, service it, move it on. If it doesn't, continue the strike. Then the Railway Managers Association go to the courts and demand that the federal courts issue an injunction breaking the strike on the grounds that it's disrupting federal mail delivery, which they did. Without even investigating how DABS was responding to this, they just issued an injunction declaring the strike to be in violation of federal law. Well, DABS believed, falsely, but he believed that as long as there truly was no mail delivery interruption, that they couldn't be convicted. Couldn't be convicted of a court order that didn't apply to a real violation of federal law, which he was wrong. He was arrested and taken to court. Strike was broken. In the process of all this going on, the Railway Managers Association jumped right over the head of the governor of Illinois, John Peter Altgeld, and appealed to Grover Cleveland. They kind of trumped up and exaggerated the conditions, making it sound like these workers are going to go like the 1877 thing into, you know, citywide, nationwide strike. So Cleveland sent federal troops to Chicago to run the railroads. So federally manned troops take care of all the railroad delivery long after the problem is over, long after the strike's broken, and long after Debs is in jail. And Cleveland kind of made a lot of political hay out of it, saying if it takes every troop in the American military to send a postcard in Chicago, that postcard's going to get sent. And the reason for that is because Cleveland was getting blamed totally for the panic of 1893, and he wanted to do something that made himself look strong in regards to this labor unrest. Well, Debs, out on bond, makes an interesting decision. He says, the corporate lawyer who works for the Pullman Company, who is defending them against me in this case, is a man named Clarence Darrow. And Clarence Darrow is one of the most interesting persons in history. He's a lawyer that throughout his life defended the underdog. As a youth, he watched his parents conduct Underground Railroad protection for runaway slaves. So he'd always been involved in justice causes, liberal causes. And he will be associated with a number of cases you may have heard of, the Loeb-Leopold affair of 1911, the first time that the insanity plea was used in a death case. He was involved in that and got the person's life in prison rather than executed. He was involved in the Scopes trial of 1925 involving the teaching of evolution. He had defended a number of IWW leaders when they were accused of killing mine owners in a dynamite explosion. The Scottsboro case, which involved 9 African Americans being accused of rape and murder, totally false. They were innocent, not even at the time. It went to the Supreme Court. That eventually resulted in, if you never had a lawyer on your side, you've been denied your rights of counsel and a death penalty issue. All of these are the cases that Darrow had been a part of. So he's well remembered. In fact, he's remembered in his biographies as the attorney of the damned, fighting for the underdog. Well, this is back early in his career, and he's a corporate lawyer trying to make do with profits, and Darrow hasn't been happy with himself since he's been working for the Pullman Company. He feels in all this mess that occurred in the strike that he's really on the wrong ethical side of things. So when Debs comes to his house and says to Clarence Darrow, I know you represent the Pullman Company, and what I'm going to ask you makes no sense at all, but I'm asking you to give up your cushy job and paycheck and instead switch sides, defend me, and I can't pay you a penny. He said, I'll do it. So Darrow did so. And as a result of that, instead of getting like 20 years in prison, Debs got 6 months in prison, still for violating. They concluded he had not disrupted mail delivery, but he was still guilty of violating the court injunction, even though the court injunction now made no sense. But Debs became famous as a victim. Darrow became famous as a lawyer for the underdog. And in those 6 months that he served in jail, Debs kind of came to the conclusion that the reason all this occurs is what we said before, laws on the side of the owners, not the workers. And in the long run, only when the law really truly is representative of working class people will it be fair and just. So he decides upon leaving prison that he needs time to not just be a union organizer, but to organize a third political party, the American Socialist Party, the Democratic Socialists of America. Which I've always said someday I'm going to join after I retire and have a careful, protected retirement. How's that for a cowardly leftist? That's me. Well, my son's already joined. He's 25. I keep thinking, I hope he's keep getting a job. But anyway, that's just the way I look at that. So The Henry Debs case, which I know not a lot about, was the appeal of Debs to the Supreme Court, and it was related to the fact that the RMA had used the Sherman Antitrust Act as a way of upholding the conviction, arguing that the American Railway Union had engaged in monopolistic tactics with their strike. So that same year that the E.C. Knight Company, Sugar Company, was acquitted on the grounds of being a wholesaler, here's Debs and the ARU being convicted for being monopolists because of their strike. In 1896 is when he forms the American Socialist Party. And let me add this, it was not a communist party. Socialism is a big school of thought. There are various forms of socialistic philosophy. There's Christian socialism, communitarianism, and there is Marxian socialism, the communist brand. And Debs was always very uncomfortable with Marxian socialism. I mean, he was interested in the philosophy but very opposed to the tactics. And the reason is as simple as this. Marxian socialism has this view that there is owners and there are workers. The workers are the good guys, the owners are the bad guys. And it's very difficult to get the owners to be sympathetic to workers' rights, so you have to expunge, that's a softer word there, you have to eliminate the owners. And eventually when all the owners are expunged and eliminated, then all you'll have left is workers who set up such a glorious system that you don't even need a government anymore. That's just, anarchy will naturally result because you'll have a network of workers who all treat each other just fine and don't exploit each other. So, but it's achieved through violent revolution, the Marxian system. And Debs always believed that the way to achieve a socialist measure was through the ballot box, that you enlighten the public to what is best for all, and they willingly vote in socialism, which takes a lot longer. You can't come out of the barrel of a smoking gun in your lifetime, kind of thing. So that's where Debs had his problems with that. And a lot of founders of this party in their youth believed by the 1930s that it was really going to come about. During the New Deal years, it looked like they actually people would vote in those measures, not knowing that FDR would steal their thunder and implement all kinds of quasi-socialist measures but never become a socialist himself in the 30s. But a decade later, in 1906, Debs gets with two other famous leaders, Daniel De Leon, Caribbean-born socialist organizer, and the very flamboyant Big Bill Haywood, and created the IWW, which stands for the Industrial Workers of the World. The IWW was probably the closest thing to a serious communist movement that existed. It's not so much they were Marxian in theory, as it was they were just violent in attitude, and that's what drove Debs out of it. Debs just was always trying to consider that the IWW needs to be a parallel union to go with a political party. The IWW organizes workers to get them to vote in the socialist movement, but the IWW wanted to organize a union that blew up mines and took over the place and ran things. And so that's why he left it. And they were nicknamed the Wobblies. There's a story of how that came about. Supposedly, IWW was strongest in mines and its organizing efforts. And there was a restaurant in Denver that IWW workers used to frequent on a regular basis, a Chinese restaurant. Apparently, the story has that the Chinese owner was always so happy to see the IWW members come through the door that he would say, "Here comes the IWW." But when he would say it, the pronunciation was so twisted that people thought he said, "Here comes the Wobblies." So that's one of the sources of where the nickname Wobblies came from for the IWW. They were anarcho-syndicalist in spirit. And we've kind of already talked about that, and that is believed in anarchism, but also believed in syndicated workers' networks. So they're this dreamy group that believes that you're going to be able to organize workers across national boundaries. Canadian, American, German, French, South African, Middle Eastern, Chinese. I mean, they believe that someday industrial workers worldwide will network up in this IWW unit and have more voice and power than individual governments will. And that's one of the reasons these radical unions, and especially the IWW, was so opposed to World War I. Their thinking about World War I is capitalists on one side of the ocean get the working class to build the weapons and do the dying to fight capitalists on the other side of the ocean doing the same to their working class. So that's kind of the attitude. And in the Red Scare that occurs in the post-World War I period, almost all of the IWW leaders are driven off to Russia or elsewhere. which allows us to switch over to a new topic now, and that is something we alluded to a little earlier, immigration. And it may look like a misnomer to call it old and new immigration when it's all taking place in the 19th century. That leaves 20th century immigration out of the picture. Well, let's talk some about this. We're still in the Gilded Age. We did some of this already, so this won't sound all that new. From the beginning of the nation, we're on item 39. From the beginning of the nation up through the early infant stage of the 1830s, most of the immigrants, the steady flow of immigrants to America, are coming from British Isles and somewhat from France or Western Germany. But primarily it's either France, French refugees coming from the French Revolution, or it's Scottish, Gaelic, Celtic, Irish, and British coming. So except for the Irish, most of these people are going to pretty much share and embrace the same cultural habits and attributes of the people already here, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So there's not going to be that kind of a cultural conflict or friction that will be felt later when the people who are coming pretty much reflect those of the majority who are here. As number 40 shows, in the 1840s and through 1860s, the numbers shift away from the British Isles, except for the Irish, to include Germans. In fact, the Irish community and the German community almost consumes most of the immigrants coming from Europe. And that will create changes as more and more Irish come. And the Irish who came before the 1840s usually were the upper class that spoke English and worldly in the ways of getting through business, etc. The Irish that come after the 1846-47 period, they are victims of the potato blight, potato famine experience. And I think I may have mentioned the fact that of the 3 million people that lived in Ireland, one-third died, one-third migrated, and one-third remained. And so the majority of the third that migrated came to America. They're not as well received as others because of their Catholic background and because ethnically they were considered lesser white people, as Celtic people. Germans also come in this time period. Germans are considered ethnically more similar to the Anglo-Saxon stock. Germans were more than 50% Protestant Lutherans rather than Catholics, and most Germans had a lot more money in their pockets when they came, so they're better received. So except for the Irish, we're still looking at an immigration from the start of the nation up to the 1860s and 70s that is, for the most part, close to reflecting what was already here in the majority. So it's population growth, it's welcome because it usually fuels economic growth, and there's not, except in the case in the Irish, a whole lot of guardedness against cultural change. As we see here from 1860 to 1890, in that 30-year period, 10 million immigrants from Northern and Western Europe come. And while it's still basically the same numbers we're looking at, there's a far greater number of German and Scandinavian and Austrian immigrants coming. Still, this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant majority tends to rule. When we move to the next page in item 41, that's when the drastic changes start to occur culturally. Almost to the year, in 1890, the immigration sources start to change away from Western and Northern Europe to Southern and Eastern Europe. And the groups listed here make up the majority of those coming. And they're coming at a rate of well over 1 million a year. From Italy, Russia, Polish immigrants, Lithuanian, none of them hardly Protestant, many Jewish or Roman Catholic, and what was it about Catholicism that made people so, did we talk about this already? I think we may have. We didn't? Why would a Catholic person even, just leave ethnicity out of it for the moment. If it's an Anglo-Saxon Catholic. Catholics were always suspect in America all the way until 1960, I think. Klan. Pardon? That's it. Always this belief that they may study the Constitution and move to America and own property, but somehow, some way, they can live here 30, 40 years and they're still sleeper cells, the Al-Qaeda sleeper cells, waiting for the Pope. give the marching orders. I mean, it sounds ludicrous now, but it was well believed. It goes back to European feelings, that in Europe there were nations were either Protestant or Catholic, and if you were in a Protestant nation like Britain, then Catholics were very, very always suspect for their national loyalty. The wars that occurred in the German states usually were which province was predominantly Catholic or Protestant, and people moved to one province and the other and killed each other if they didn't. So there was always a lot of suspicion on the part of Protestant majorities towards Catholics in their midst. In the Irish case, you had Catholicism with ethnicity, and you got twice as much problem occurring. And the same would be true for Polish, Italian, etc., because these Eastern Europeans of Slavic background are looked down upon as lesser ethnic people. Italians and other Mediterraneans and Spaniards, it's Portuguese, it's looked on the same way. But Catholicism was always, Catholics were always looked upon with great suspicion about to what degree their loyalty could be suspect. There wouldn't be a Catholic presidential candidate till 1928, and he would lose. And the second person to be a presidential candidate was whom? Yeah, and did we mention the fact that even before he could be a serious contender, he had to go to a convention of Baptist ministers in Houston and be grilled with a number of questions about, and the same question over and over, do you support the Constitution of the Pope? And he had to keep saying, no, I support the Constitution. And finally convince those Baptist ministers who gave their approval for him to run. When would be the next time a presidential candidate would be a Catholic after Kennedy? I'm thinking only one. Maybe I'm missing one, but it'd be a JFK from Massachusetts. Yep, John Forbes Kerry was the next one. So, we had a Catholic vice presidential candidate. Who was that? But let me rephrase that. Who was she?
Geraldine.
Yep, Geraldine Ferraro, the Italian Catholic school teacher from New York. Does that sound like a big vote getter? I'm not being anti, you know, gender here. I'm just. What year was Geraldine Ferraro placed on the ticket? Mm-hmm. Why was she placed on the ticket? I'd say so, definitely because of a female. But wasn't that a way in that time? Do you think the American public was ready to vote for a woman in 1984? No. My mother wasn't. We talked about it. I kept trying to explain to her. This sounds so bad for you to talk like that. She says, no, I just don't think a woman should be in that office in case the president dies. So if the public wasn't ready, why would the Democrats do it? I think it's this. You can't beat Reagan in a second term. They're going to re-coronate this guy no matter what. And since Reagan's going to win, why not be the party that can claim that they're the first to and keep women in the party? And I think it was a sound move because women have, that's not the only reason, but women have stayed solidly associated with the Democratic Party. That's probably a step forward. Reagan was asked what he thought about the Democrats beating the Republicans on being the first to nominate a woman for vice president. See, it's kind of like being the first to nominate one to the court, isn't it? Which he did with Sandra Day O'Connor back in 82. But I've walked off of the topic here. What I'm getting at is to the theme of all this wandering is that despite ethnicity or money or power or influence, Catholics still were suspect. And you can well imagine Catholics who were not Anglo-Saxons were even more suspect. And Catholics who were not Anglo-Saxon or didn't have money, even more so. So that is what helped create cultural friction for these newer immigrants that came from 1890 up to about 1920. The belief that the Roman Catholic Church is non-democratic and is set up like a military unit, and that the Pope wants to take over the world and he sends these Catholic agents to all these countries. I mean, that's Anglo-Saxon.
Yes,
Protestant.
All this stuff like before the Protestant Reformation and stuff.
But the Protestant Reformation is what, 1500s? And
yeah.
Here it is, 1890?
Yeah, well, how long did the Catholic Church keep Europe under its thumb?
That's Europe. Shouldn't have Americans had their heads out? You would tend to think. No, obviously the answer is no. I mean, that America's prejudices still reflected the old world ways. So I guess the reason I kind of stress this now is that for those who feel now that Hispanic immigrants who are Catholic and different languages and maybe in economically pressed situations constitute some kind of a cultural threat. This is not at all new. This is something that occurred at the turn of the century and all eventually well assimilated. One of the criticisms of these groups when they came was that they didn't want to assimilate. They did not want to learn the language quickly. They did not want to move into the neighborhoods of others, that they enclaved up into their own communities and refused to learn English. Well, there's some truth to that in the sense that if you feel besieged and hated, you do organize with like kind to protect yourselves. But really, by second generation children, they had learned the language and moved in. It's with my old Borg theory, you have no choice, you'll be assimilated. Item 42. They became very, very important to the Democratic Party. Most definitely Catholics, most Eastern and Southern Europeans, solid Democratic Party voters. Why so? Well, we'll talk more about this later when we talk about the differences in the parties. But the Democratic Party had been the party of the working class underdog back to the Jackson years. That's one of the reasons for it. And so while I'm not saying everybody in the party treated them racially equal, it was more one of those things where they all voted together but didn't dare be seen having dinner together. But they were useful in numbers, just like the way African-American voters were treated in the South. As long as they were useful in voting, they were welcomed into the party. Another reason for their desire to join that party was the Democratic Party was the party of laissez-faire, such a reverse since the 1930s. But culturally, a lot of these immigrants are thinking the smaller government is, the more our culture is protected from Protestantism. Our private Catholic schools can exist if there's less government interference. The other party, the Republican Party, often spoke about the need of making a Protestant nation and making our education system reflect Protestantism. So there was a feeling of cultural danger and attack by the Republican Party, and the Democrats didn't send that signal. Democrats, more often than not, dominated the city governments in northern and eastern places like Boston, New York, Philadelphia, etc. And so it's not surprising that immigrants became a useful tool for city governments, and especially it was assumed that the immigrant vote helped keep a lot of corrupt political bosses in power. And that's probably true. And that they weren't well-versed in reading the newspaper accounts of what kind of scandals and graft and corruption was taking place by the parties they were voting for. But even had they known, even had these immigrants realized how much these political bosses were ripping off the cities, they probably would have kept voting for them anyway, because the bosses did something others did not. They provided services. This was a time period when there weren't a lot of city services available. And so who cleaned the streets? Nobody did. The trash was thrown out to rot on the streets every day. And if the bosses could get a certain precinct or community to turn out solidly all the vote, they'd have the streets cleaned that month for them. If somebody's kid got arrested, boss went down, got him out of jail. Somebody needed their teeth fixed, they'd take them there. So just by providing services for the people, was a lot of it under the table and illegal, but it was what government's supposed to be doing, providing services for the people, and then correspondingly the people vote for them. One of the great, great criticisms of the New Deal, when the national government began to create work and spend money to put people back to work, was it ripped all the power out of city bosses. They no longer had the ability or the resources to provide favors because they were in competition with the national government. While we're speaking of these corrupt city bosses and city governments, the best one and the most famous one was in New York City in the 1870s, a guy named William Marcy Tweed, the Tweed Ring being considered the most of lavish and flamboyant. They led what lasted for over a century, Tammany Hall, New York. Tammany Hall was the political machine of which Tweed was a member. William Marcy Tweed. The way Tammany Hall in general, but especially the Tweed Ring, stayed in power through these tactics listed in item 43. Tombstone voting. What that means is that people would register under many, many different names, some of them living people, most not, and go from place to place and vote, seemingly legal. As long as the Tweed Ring ran the voting procedures. It really didn't matter how well they were checked for their authenticity of their identification. Speaking of that, for years my son was registered here in Fort Smith as well as in Fayetteville because he was a student up there but lived here. And we tried over and over to get his names off the Fort Smith rolls, and it always kept coming up. When I'd go to vote, I'd say, is my son still registered? And there he was every time. I wonder if people really worked at it today, how many times they could vote in this state and get away with it and never get caught because people don't purge the voting rolls. And then they're supposed to today. Just think what they did back in this day and age. What was the quote by Richard Daley, the last of the bosses in Chicago? We encourage people to get out and vote early and often. So it's kind of that way of things. My wife's from the Philippines, and she tells me that's just the standard way for Philippine politics, that we're so fussy about details in America about honest voting. But she tells me that's not what I'm going to say. If regular, ordinary, real voting wasn't enough, then they just stuffed the ballot boxes of what it would take to win the election. So they found ways to stay in office. And, of course, the best way was through patronage, the term we were just talking about earlier, and that is patronage is to provide jobs to people who can bring the whole community over. So if you, the most prominent members of the Italian community, the most prominent members of the Polish community, if they get a good cushy government job, they're going to make sure they tell all their cousins and friends and turn out the vote. Maybe not all that different than today. Thomas Nast fits into our story here. He was a cartoonist, probably the most famous cartoonist of the 19th century. He created the donkey and the elephant as political symbols for the parties, and using both of them in critical, sarcastic way, and then the parties eventually adopted them as their own. But Nast made it a big crusade to go after Tweed. And his purpose was, he said, that immigrants who can't read English can't realize how much money he and his cronies are stealing, but political cartoons might show it. And so through the use of political cartoons, portraying him as a vampire, portraying him as a vulture and as a tiger and many other different forms, immigrants came to realize that they were not getting anywhere near the services that they were providing for in the vote. That most of the money that could have been used for improving city conditions were going lining the pockets of his cronies. And Nast's cartooning finally led to his being put on trial. And while on trial, Tweed jumped bail, fled to Europe. But Spanish readers, looking at syndicated wire service cartoons of Nast, recognized him from the cartoons, and he was arrested and extradited back and imprisoned. Why don't we, when we return, pick up 44 through 47, and then we'll turn into the next section, which starts with the number one again about politics. So 44 through 47, and then on the new set of sheets when we return.
On Israel. I just saw the little thing about letting out cluster bombs in populated areas.
I heard that there was...